Andy, my dude, have you heard of the magical website builder known as Squarespace?
Ugh, not another Squarespace ad. I feel like every podcast is sponsored by them.
Hey, don't knock it until you try it. Yes, okay, it is overhyped, but actually it lives up to the hype. Squarespace is like a website fairy godmother. With a click of a button, your site transforms into a beautiful masterpiece.
A website fairy godmother? That sounds interesting. What makes it so magical?
Well, for starters, those slick templates make anyone look like a professional web designer. Pick one, customize the colors and fonts to match your brand, and voila. Plus, the drag-and-drop fluid engine is so easy, your grandma could build a site on Squarespace.
Well, she did knit me a lovely scarf last Christmas. Maybe website design is next.
Exactly. And when you're ready to sell your Nana's handmade scarves online, Squarespace has built-in e-commerce. Add a store with one click, get flexible payment options, then watch those sales roll in. And when she wants to teach others her steezy scarf skills, Squarespace's new courses feature is just the ticket. Nana can set up her curriculum and enrollments and payments in a snap and become the next e-knitting influencer.
Ugh, wow, you really sold me with the grandma angle. Sign me up for that free trial.
Just go to thenextreel.com/Squarespace and transform your site into a beautiful Squarespace masterpiece.
Well, thanks, Pete. Even though it's overhyped, Squarespace actually sounds perfect for Nana's site's needs. Appreciate the warning on the ads, though. I'll brace myself next time I listen to a podcast.
Anytime. Let me know if you need any help getting that site up and running. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. Gathers, the gang of thugs is here to take on a movie currently in theaters and spoil it rotten. And this month, we're taking the stage with the Tatum behind his third run as his spiritual alter ego, Mike Lane, in Steven Soderbergh's latest return from retirement, Magic Mike's Last Dance.
What did you want before Miami?
I just wanted to escape my life. I need you. Do you like bartending?
It's not really what I do.
What is it that you really do? Beside me, but then you came along and gave me this unexpected, magical moment that made me remember who I really was. Come with me to London. Let's go. So
are you in London?
I'm gonna put on a show at this famous theater.
People are numb, disconnected. We're gonna wake them up with a wave of passion they've never felt before.
Hell yeah.
Without further ado, I give you the visionary artist's magic mind.
So,
the real question is, why do you love her?
No one's believed in me like your mom has. So what's this show about?
It's the same old, will she marry for love or money?
So what does she pick, love or money?
The real question is, why does she feel like she has to choose?
It sounds to me she just needs to let go.
And some good.
Maybe that as well.
Welcome, everybody. Grab a plumber and a ballerina because this is Channing Tatum's magnum opus. And this time we get the story all the way from gold blimey London. I'm Pete Wright, and I'm joined round the pole by Steve Sarmento.
Sup?
Justin J.J. Yeager.
Hello, hello. Happy to be here dancing.
And Tommy Metz.
Blomp. Blomp, blomp.
I've heard that song more this week than I've ever heard.
Pony?
It was supposed to be Pony.
Blomp, blomp, blomp.
I don't know. Oh, you guys. I want to talk about... We've never done a Magic Mike on any of the Next Reel shows. We've never done a Magic
Mike.
Really?
That's a tragedy.
I know. I'm as shocked as you are. I think it is a tragedy. A tragedy? Tragedy. Tragedy.
I heard you.
Nobody knows what that word is. And so I want to at least start, as we set up this conversation, with your experience with the Magic Mike cinematic universe, Magic Mike, and of course, Magic Mike XXL. Where do you all stand with the Magic's Mike? JJ?
Well, Soderbergh is generally my favorite director. When we talk about a director that I pretty much like his work, or all of the director's work, it's Steven Soderbergh. So when I was introduced to the first Magic Mike, I was very pleasantly surprised. I remember when it was coming out, the subject matter, everything, I was like, oh, this is Soderbergh, but I don't know if I'm going to like it. And then I loved it. I thought it was a really wonderful subculture tale that made for some epic human relationships, and it was wildly entertaining. I loved it. And then I didn't see XXL because maybe I brought some of those preconceived notions to that movie too. I did see it leading up to this movie this week, and I really loved XXL as well for completely different reasons. Enjoyed it in all different kinds of ways. And so I got really excited about the franchise, which is, I think, ultimately your question here, because it felt like there are different movies about the same subject matter that were really entertaining. And so so I got really excited, and my expectations got a little high for this particular Last Dance movie.
He's teasing it out there. Steve, what do you think? Where are you on Magic Mike?
I'm a similar place mostly as JJ. I saw the first one, and because, again, Soderbergh, and was really impressed with how it was an interesting story within a setting that we just normally don't get. And I thought, this is an interesting character piece. On rewatching it, prepping for this, I realized, I think one of the problems with that is you sort of have this like dual protagonist type of thing trying to balance itself out. It's called Magic Mike, but we really start off with the Alex Pettifer character who, you know, then disappears, but he's sort of our audience surrogate. And so it felt a little clunky in some parts trying to balance those things out. I had not seen Magic Mike XXL. I think probably because Soderbergh didn't direct that one. So I wasn't sure if the franchise was branching off to become its own separate thing. So I did watch.
Still a producer, though.
Still a producer. Yes. Yep. So I did watch it to prep for this.
Well, and he shot it and he edited it.
Yes.
He did. Didn't know that.
Yes. It's not like he didn't.
No,
he didn't have a hand.
Peter Andrews, the second one?
Yes. Yes.
He did? I didn't know that.
He shot that one. So which I didn't know. I think when XXL came out, there's the title, it's a different director. I was like, it's the studio trying to just, you know, cash in on this franchise. But I really, really enjoyed it because whereas the first one was this interesting study of a character, this was like a buddy road trip movie with XXL. And it was, as JJ said, something completely different. And I really, really enjoyed that. So coming into the third one, I thought, oh, I'm on board for this franchise. So am I a huge fan? No, but they are more enjoyable than I thought that I was expecting them to be.
Okay, Tom, your Magic Mike's origin story.
Yes, I think I watched the first one for two reasons. Of course, Steven Soderbergh, but also I was like, Channing Tatum, he can't hold a movie. That's like asking someone bad to hold a movie. And I remember just being blown away by how charismatic he is, how talented he is. He is just a straight up star. For me, even though they're doing very different things, he's what I feel like. I don't have that kind of response to like The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, or anything like that. I just find him to be like pleasant and game, whereas Channing Tatum is like legitimately funny and so funny in things like the other, not the other guys, 21 Jump Street, stuff like that. So,
yeah.
And he's such an amazing dancer. I loved the first one so much. The second one, it's interesting that, because that kind of weirds out my original point, which was I really noticed Steven Soderbergh not there in the second one. So many things apart from the performances felt so flat to me, felt very forced, felt very just a lot of more camera just sitting there. Now, I don't know what that means now that I know that Steven Soderbergh filmed it. Potentially that was a preconception going in. If I was like maybe subconsciously like, oh, it's another director and he's never really done anything that big sense, that I was probably like, eh, and let that sort of go. Yeah, I also got very uncomfortable with some of the performances in Magic Mike XXL. But either way, I was so happy to see this one, because to see Last Dance, because I liked the basic idea of it and the end. I'm keeping my tearaway pants on.
Yeah, now, okay. Right? Guess, keep those on. I don't need to see the thong yet. So I am with you. One of the things that I really love about Magic Mike and what it does is just how bold Channing Tatum is personally as a performer in putting this story on screen. Because in Magic Mike, it is Pettifer's character that is Channing Tatum in real life, right? He was the stripper when he was 18, 19, working a roofing job, getting the gig to become a stripper. And according to his an interview he did, the very first thing he had to do was, you know, they apparently haze each other by making each other do dances in different, like, you know, firemen and policemen, and they do all the things. And his was a Boy Scout. His very first dance was a Boy Scout. Probably. And it was a very creepy song that he had to do it to. I can't remember it right off the top of my head.
That's so creepy. Have you seen any footage? Is there a way?
and he was so, like, that as a part of his life is... like, I think it's a bold choice to make a movie like this, and for Soderbergh to be behind it, knowing that Soderbergh has his, you know, he's unafraid to make movies about some, you know, taboo subject matter. Wasn't it Soderbergh? Didn't he do The Girlfriend Experience?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is like him balancing the scales, right, in terms of gender equality. And, you know, we're going to make a movie about prostitution. We're going to make a movie about male strippers. It's fine. Everybody, the universe is balanced. I loved the first Magic Mike. That movie had no business. It's like a razor's edge from being a ridiculously stupid movie to being something with enormous heart. And it had enormous heart. And Magic Mike XXL was pitch perfect, but with male strippers. It's like the ultimate sort of mindless road trip movie. Everybody's got to get to nationals, right? Like, it just felt like that kind of a thing.
Regionals,
and yeah. I thought this whole movie was so dumb, but all of them in a bus together, in that food truck together, having the experience of Tarzan and Tito and Ken and Richie all trying to like figure out what masculinity is in friendships. And then the stunning big performance at the end, that mirror performance where they're doing their thing opposite each other on the Twitch frame on stage was extraordinary. That was extraordinary. I was so moved by that. And then I thought, oh, right. This is what it feels like to have body image issues.
and the other thing is you're also leaving out some of the stuff along the way, right? I mean, the whole scene with like Andy McDowell and like relating to aging and marriage and all, like they're doing this great. It's this great overall story. I love the Pitch Perfect comparison because I agree. And then there's so many amazing performances and all these great little sub stories in it too, with Jada Pinkett Smith and Andy McDowell and then then you get Elizabeth Smart at the end. It's just all these great things, and it's loaded with. It's like an amazing ice cream scoop with tons of great, crunchy, wonderful flavors in it. And that, and I thought XXL was great for those reasons, and I was super impressed with it. I laughed a lot.
So I think that takes us to a central question leading into this movie.
Yeah.
I don't believe anybody else. I think Channing Tatum is Magic Mike, and Magic Mike is Channing Tatum. Absolutely. And those two movies, the last two movies, prove that for me. Going into this movie, I wondered if there can be a Magic Mike movie without Magic Mike and Tarzan and Tito and Ken and Richie. Would the movie hold up without the core group that made up this sort of band of masculinity seeking, toxicity avoiding, and yet sexual guys trying to figure out the world together? And so I ask you, did the movie stand up to that test?
No. For me, unfortunately, no. I don't. I'm of two minds about this movie. I like that it knows for the most part what we're there for, and I have trouble understanding why so much of it is not that. When it's that, it hits. When it's not, it doesn't. It robs us. It puts so much pressure really just on Channing Tatum.
Yes.
As far as charisma, as far as wit, as far as everything, I personally found, and this is just, I didn't find any chemistry except for the beginning dance between him and
Salma Hayek.
Penault?
Yeah.
What's Penault, her last name? Right.
Penault. Yep, her new last name.
The dance was outstanding in the beginning. The problem for me is the movie peaked early, then it went on for a while, then there was the bus scene. And then it went on for a while, and then the final show. And that went on for a whiles was bereft. What it was missing was the himbos. It was missing people to interact with that had actual backstories and different personalities. We got to see them in a Zoom. That does not count. So no. For me, it was just sort of, we were just adrift in London for me.
Yeah.
When it worked, it really worked.
JJ, when Tom said no, your head went sideways on our recording. Why did it about go chemistry. Sideways?
Well, about chemistry? I think, well, my thing in for the movie is I completely agree with that. They sort of let go. That they released really the content of what is a Magic Mike movie. But I think in answer to your question, I don't think I was particular. I don't think I needed the himbos. And what I mean is that specific group of himbos to make it a Magic Mike movie. I think that if Channing Tatum was the focus of this one, it would have been fine. And I actually didn't expect to see the other guys. I was mad about the Zoom because it was relatively unnecessary. It was just something inserted. So I would have liked to have seen more dancing. And so I agree with Tom on that part. But the thing that bothered me most about the Magic Mike character in this movie was that he actually seemed somewhat irrelevant too. This wasn't that much about Mike's journey. It wasn't much about Mike's life. All the details about Mike here were sort of like, we went and got him because he's going to come and revitalize this other story. And I don't dislike this other story. I think there's, you know, the part about changing theater for women's empowerment and really the Selma Hayek character finding freedom and getting released. That stuff is an interesting story, but this is the Magic Mike franchise and we miss the dancing and we really kind of missed a lot of Mike Lane in this story, unfortunately. So, so my feelings about it is that, yes, it was a Magic Mike story, but it's different. Again, different than the first two. And I was again, wildly entertained by the stuff that I like about them. But I felt like it was an unnecessary love story. I felt like there was a lot of really weird stuff that really didn't need to be in the movie for us to enjoy what we were watching.
Yeah, Steve, your take on what the Selma Hayek character was doing to lift the story up. I was struggling to figure out, are we trying to recapture the sequence from XXL with Andy McDowell and make it a whole movie?
No.
No. It didn't play, Steve?
No. This is a Steven Soderbergh film. And as I watched this, I watched this and there were several sequences where I went, oh, we're combining Step Up and Ocean's 11. This is what we're doing. Because right. if you look at
there's a whole heist part.
There's a whole yeah. heist part. Yeah. There's, as I've thought about it, Salma Hayek is Danny Ocean. Channing Tatum is the Brad Pitt Rusty character who's sort of the sidekick to help bring this vision through. Because it's really about, you know, what's her name? Maxandra, right? It's all about her trying to pull off this big show. And Mike is there as this sidekick to help her do that. So there's that aspect of it. The other part that, and maybe my theater had this and yours didn't, I don't know. Before the movie started, there was a little short piece that sort of did a whole recap of the first movie and the second movie. And there was Channing Tatum. And he was in voiceover, he's saying, after Magic Mike XXL, they did, you can go to Vegas, whatever, see the Magic Mike show. There's a whole like stage show. He said, and putting that show together was the genesis of the idea for another Magic Mike movie. Because as they had to put together a stage show, like, what is that about? That is where this movie came from. The seed for that story came out of that. So there was, so I thought, oh, okay, we're going to, it's all about creating the show. So I had that information going into it. I see Soderbergh pulling out his Ocean's 11 bits and pieces. And for me, everything clicked along really, really well. There, did you also have the, at the beginning, the Salma Hayek and Channing Tatum like, hey, thanks for coming to the movies to see our...
No! What?
Okay.
What?
None of that.
Okay, so what there...
Did you, you watching this movie at Channing Tatum's house?
No, it was on the...
It was on you said he wasn't going to go back
I know. But they, you know how they always have those, like, thank you for coming out and all that? It was that type of thing, but it wasn't that because it's them...
We got none of that.
Channing Tatum starts talking. Salma comes in, talks about how much fun she had doing this. They just had this great natural chemistry together, and then they just sort of like, you know, finish, giggle and like walk off. And I was like, oh, this isn't the thanks, you know, for, you know, coming out and, you know, supporting Hollywood or all that. It was just this like little bit between the two of them. So it established the chemistry between those two for me.
I would have liked that.
I had Maria Menounos.
Yes.
After that. So, reminding me that popcorn exists.
Yes. So I need to tell you. So we had Newbie, but also in the ads, the ads running up to the movie. I don't know if you guys had this. Maybe you didn't have this. There was an ad for a strip club
in Florida.
Yes,
had that.
You saw it too.
Yes. Okay, good. Yes,
like literally a male entertainer strip club in Florida. That was an ad, and they gave the website and said, "Come here to celebrate your special night," which they're talking about bachelorette parties, these kind of things.
Yeah,
and I thought that was so great. It was produced in a way that made me wonder if it was a gag.
Yes.
Like wondered if it was part of the film because it was so like this kind of thing, but it's actually kind of just fun, smart marketing. That's way before it during the movie stuff. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
It's like a Fathom Events. About Coyote.
Right. Yes, exactly.
So I had all of those things. And so when I got into the story, everything worked really, really well. I felt like the chemistry, that scene where they're out to, they go out to the dinner with her friends and she's had a little bit too much to drink. And they had that scene in the car for me worked really, really well about this, what she set up, how she's behaving. For me, that just rang really, it felt really natural. There was something about that I appreciate about Soderbergh is there's that either improvisational nature to how he shoots or whatever that just takes people's guard down and they're just humans with each other. And I saw, like, I felt a lot of that between the two. That's just my take.
I think that's really interesting, Steve, because I think given that experience, I don't think we can understate how important that bit of like table setting was for you, because I didn't have it and did not have that same experience with their charisma. I think your setup of having this as some combination of Step Up and Ocean's 11 is really good, except for it's not enough Step Up and it's absolutely not enough Ocean's 11. Like,
agreed.
We have these 10 guys standing on stage that are automatons. Like, they have no personality at all. They're given nothing to work with. We get a little bit of the former star. And let's just say, you know, we've been prattling on about this, that the story of Magic Mike, his last dance, Mike is broke. His business making found object furniture was taken under by the pandemic. So he's broken in debt to his former stage mates. So he follows the road to London with a wealthy Maxandra to take this dusty old classic play and turn it into something to shake Britain's britches. That's pretty good, right? Yeah, I spent like an hour on that. I'm sorry, ChatGTP wrote that. So I feel like we have a little bit of Isabel, the Isabel character in the original play that they tear down in order to make this strip show. She gets to be in the show with all these men who have no character. They just dance. She gets a little bit. We have this addition of the ballerina, which was a late addition and made one of the most brilliant set pieces, dance pieces in the entire show. I adored it. Followed by the amazing dance sequence, "Hey, where did all the water go?" with all the guys.
You remember he did say, "Get me a plumber." He got a great plumber.
Great plumber, yes.
Yeah.
So there were some real high points, and I think those three, right, those dance pieces and the bus sequence
where they were, was my favorite thing.
It was extraordinary. It was just wonderful, and the way it was shot, looking right in your eyes, you know, from her POV, was really perfect. So there was a lot of really good stuff going on here, but when it didn't work, it was Channing Tatum and Salma Hayek having no chemistry, weird third wheel daughter who was the voiceover to this.
So distracting.
Why was there a voice?
I don't remember a single thing that she said, and it was so distracting, and it didn't, and it was trying to like put like a smarty pants bow on something that is not smarty pants.
No. It was, she was chronicling as he's building the show. She's talking about it's really just, she's talking about dance. Like it's to give the audience how dance is part of culture. It started off as, you know, ways of communicating, you know, all of those pieces. So for me, it was sort of paralleling the development of the show by looking at how does dance function in our culture? What does it do? What is its role in how we interact with each other? And to me, it was a commentary on that as the show he's putting on is deconstructing, you know, this old, you know, crummy play.
But it didn't really deconstruct the old crummy play that much.
No.
And it wasn't, there's lofty ideas behind this thing that never showed up. That's why my biggest complaint about the movie is it feels more like a sketch of a plot than a plot.
Yes.
I don't really believe any single part of it. I don't believe their love relationship. I don't believe that he knows how to direct a show. I don't believe that she knows how to produce a show. And I don't believe that they pulled it off. But we were told it all through like montage and wow, 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 which is okay because when it worked, it worked. Like I'm really not trying to be a fuddy-dud about the movie overall. Yeah. But it just, to go way back, and I'm sorry that I'm interrupting, but I think it's a good time to do it, is if I hadn't known that this was the same screenwriter that did the first two Magic Mikes, I would have had to assume this was an existing project that then they shoehorned and made into a Magic
Mike. That's certainly what it felt like to me.
Because the DNA is so different and it's trying to do different things. And then they're like, oh, right, dancing.
Well, right. And Steve, everything you say about the voiceover is true. That's what they're trying to do and sort of explain dance in the culture. But it in the franchise, it doesn't actually really fit in. So it is a different kind of movie, which, like I said in the intro, that's kind of what I liked about the first two. So I get that they're doing it, but it really didn't make sense to me in the whole scheme of things. The voiceover took me out of the movie almost immediately. And I just wanted to get back to more dancing.
This is the challenge that I had with it too, is that first of all, I have grown to hate voiceover just in general. I hate it. It's a cinematic sin and needs to be used so precisely for it to actually work that I just prefer not to have it. And they had this line in the movie, which is, as you know, very troublesome for me. Then I can claim I got Magic Mike's Last Dance.
Oh, you don't like it when they reference the title?
Oh my God. When they put the title in the movie, I just I cannot stand it.
Agreed. Agreed.
So those are two like weird. So the first one, the voiceover is like this auteur stamp. It's mm-hmm. like, we're going to try to make this haughty film. We're doing it in London. We have a British accent behind it, and it's going to be this Soderbrain kind of thing. And it did not play for me. I found it really distracting because there was no context. And by the time we get to context, we have this little duo of the butler and the daughter. I would love to hear you, anyone who wants to take it, dissect the role of the butler in this movie. Was he of any import to you on your watch?
He's three different characters, and the movie seems to think that he's comic relief. But he's three characters in one. He's the guy that knows everything.
Yes.
But he's also the guy that tries to say something and no one listens to him. Yes. And then he's also the father figure that wasn't there.
So the interesting thing, right. Tommy, that second character that you're talking about is lots of characters in this movie. They do that to Mike multiple times. They do that to Well, Selma Hayek in particular, her character cuts people off when they are trying to help. When she says, it's your idea. She did this at the dinner table, for example. She said, tell them what it's all about. And as soon as she started talking about,
that's right.
Don't say anything more. This kind of thing. So there's a lot of that doesn't make sense for their relationships in any of the relationships with the butler as well. It's very confusing why he's there. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It felt a lot like he was an Ocean's 11 character to me, where, you know, he has utility, but outside of that, he's not a character.
Steve, what do you think? I mean, I feel like you said some things about how you liked it, and then I went and started a train of all the things you liked I didn't like. Does any of this ring true?
No, I have issues with this. I mean, there are parts that I really, really enjoyed. Yeah, no, the butler is problematic because I didn't understand, because I thought, oh, he's the one that's been around since the beginning. He's got insight into this relationship. So when we're hearing things like, oh, you know, she's all first act because she never follows through on anything, and all of this, and the nature of the relationship is the friends are saying, oh, this is just a phase or whatever. She's not really leaving him. I thought, oh, he's going to have some insight. He didn't, you know, he's not, that character's potential isn't realized for whatever reason, because the story wasn't going in that direction. So I agree. He's problematic. I mean, he's there to put his hand in front of eyeballs. Right at the dance at the end. I mean, he's get him at all.
I was doing backflips trying to make him into something. Whenever he was doing those inscrutable looks in the back, I was he's going to be the foil. He's giving secret information to the husband. Why the husband always knows when to sweep? Nope.
It was a needless cutaway. Really, most of the stuff they used him for were completely useless.
And yet, to lean in on that point, Tom, like at some point, the daughter and the butler have a conversation about how the butler somehow left keys out for Mike to get into the theater. Yeah. But we never saw that, right? No. Like that was just a tell.
In every Magic Mike movie, there's some retconning, I believe. Mm-hmm. Some is very small, some is weirdly, how was that not in the script, like in XXL when he's giving the girl, like ending the mirror dance, and very clearly it's ADR'd and looks like you found your smile again. He goes, yes, thanks, Mike. Neither of them said that, but it's also like, how did you not have that in the script? That was like a hanging thread.
And that,
so there's always
and that girl, by the way, is Amber Heard. Just there's
yes.
To go into like the XXL.
That's
like,
Amber Heard?
Yes, like, that was Amber Heard.
The cast in XXL is really interesting.
Yes.
When you think really about everything that's happened to those people since that movie, it's wild.
Yeah. That's Amber Heard.
Like, look at Elizabeth Smart's trajectory. Look at, Stephen Twitch Boss's trajectory, which is just this year. And Amber Heard, I mean, Jada Pinkett Smith, that cast is wild when you look at all this stuff. But that kind of stuff, that retconning, it's done for some reason, but it's not really clear the reason why it is put there for it.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about the fact that this movie feels like it's written by a different project. All of these films were credited as written by Reed Carolyn. Mm-hmm. Reed is an often credited as a collaborator with Channing Tatum.
Oh, and, what else they do?
Dog, just recently, the Channing Tatum's Road movie. And so, you know, that's for Logan Lucky, who's a producer on Logan Lucky, 21 and 22 Jump Street, White House Down.
So they really are.
Been around on a lot of projects, whether from as a writer or a producer. And so that's great. Good for them. Oh, Earth Made of Glass is another one that he did. I actually don't know that Tatum was involved in that one. I don't think he was involved in that. Thanks, Tom. this one did feel different, but I struggled with why it was different. I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts on just the script. To me, I'm listening to these people talk, particularly Tatum and Hayek, and wondering, is this a performative challenge that I'm feeling like the words they're saying, this might have been an animated project that they were in studios separately, recording their dialogue separately without the benefit of acting together? That's kind of what it felt like to me. Like it was
almost like the two leads.
Selma Hayek and Channing Tatum. Like I really struggled with the way the words left their mouths, whether they were just poor words or poorly performed words. Does that ring true for anyone?
No, it does. Well, I don't think that I'm bad. No, I don't think that I'm bad in saying this. I hope I'm not. But one of the problems for me with their chemistry is she just seemed like an extremely messy person all the time. Mm-hmm. And then other people come in and they're like, she's always very messy. And he's like, yeah. But I see something in her, and we're like, why was all that off camera?
Did he? Yeah, but he didn't actually say that, did he? No. I don't think he said.
He said he loves her,
but he didn't say that till the end.
I didn't believe it, not even for a second.
Exactly, and that's the thing. I mean,
but the daughter said that to him, and he didn't disagree at the table when one of the many inscrutable things about the butler was like, when he's mean to you, he likes you because he doesn't like you. What? All right. Anyways, but then she goes, why are you so something about you're so crazy about her? And he's like, and I was like, well, when did this happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. It never happened. And
but they just decided that he was madly in love with her. And I was like, why?
One of the retcons, right? Yeah. Like it feels like one of the retcons.
The retcons happened in that kitchen. I'm just wondering if you were to do one day of reshoots, you just
and you had light
that kitchen and you do that's when you got keys being handed off. That's when you've got love angles. One day, two setups.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Steve, you're nodding along. What do you think? Well, you're the one who saw the chemistry.
No, I think it's there. I think the actors had chemistry with each other. There's issues with the relationship between the characters, because from the beginning, she sets it up as, look, this is a strictly a professional working relationship. I'm bringing you out here because I see you're the right person to do this. Then we slowly, you know, as we get more and more, there's, you know, about her, and I agree how messy she is. And I'm like, dude, you don't want anything to do with this mess because you don't know what's coming ever around the corner with her. That it starts to transform to, as she's talking about the show, she wants people in the audience to have that feeling that she had in that first dance. And I thought, okay, so what's going on with that? Is she trying to put barriers up, you know, then she starts trying to put the moves on him. What's going on? So unfortunately it's this woman is erratic. And I have problems with that. Cause it allows them to just say, oh, well, she's just messy. So she can act inconsistently and it's okay for that character. I'm like, well, that doesn't excuse it. We need to have, what is she trying to accomplish? And that's one of the struggles I have with this is, the discussion they have at the beginning about the play and, oh, why is it always the women have to choose between the you know, true love or the wealthy guy, you know, all that, which parallels her situation here. Like, oh, the poor guy with the heart of gold, Mike Lane, or her wealthy husband, why does she have to choose? I'm like, you told us women should have a different story. And then you just gave us the exact same story. She's got to choose between these two guys. And that's one of the things that I really struggled with was, you didn't give me a different story for her other than choosing between true love and being with the poor guy or being with the wealthy guy. And so I feel like because her character hadn't crystallized as far as who she was and where she wanted to go, they couldn't really write a nice arc for her that was going to address that issue.
Yeah, I think there's another, to add into that point, that it's not really a rags to riches story. It's a riches to rags story too.
Yeah.
That they didn't really hide. Like, we all sort of knew. I hope we all sort of knew that ticking time bomb was eventually going to go off, as you know, they set up the whole relationship with her, you know, former spouse's mother, mm-hmm. owning all of the property in the theater, and this, and that eventually all the money would revert back to the husband in their divorce, and she would be poor. Tom?
Well, I was hoping that if there was more, we're spending so much time on this thing, that the joke or the ending would be, it's a riches and love story. Mm-hmm. That for some reason she gets to go with the guy with the heart of gold and all the crappy husband's money. Mm-hmm. If he was crappier, or if they found something way to do it, she gets everything. And then that's empowering. She didn't have to choose. Instead, they just went right down the line.
Right. I understand what you guys are saying, but I also think they tried to subvert that by planting in Mike Lane's mind the fact that she was going to need to make the choice between riches and him. And then ultimately, she just never had a chance at riches. She had already left him and was trying to leave him the whole time. That's what they tell. When they talk at dinner, her friends make Mike Lane believe that she's just playing him.
Right.
And they never really hit on this part of the story enough, that she's just playing
him. She's not completely breaking him up, because then
she's staying with the rich guy. And that's what his concern is through much of the crises left in the movie. But then they come around at the end. The point that I want to make, though, is that the interesting thing about this love story, which again, I do believe is needless in this case, I like this kind of love story so much better than in It's Time for One of My Titanic Rants to Come Out, where where we have in Titanic, the, you know, Jack and Rose, it's another riches to rags story, right? Jack is stalking Rose through much of the movie, and then eventually he plies her with alcohol, they have sex, and then they're actually truly in love, right? He paints her, they do all that stuff, and they're truly in love. That's what the arc of the Titanic story is. This arc is completely different in that.
Plies her with alcohol.
I'm always waiting for a chance.
Makes her incredibly dizzy from that one dance.
And then
throws her in a cab.
Yes.
On a boat.
In the back. So now in this story, where again, I think this is a needless story, but I want to give it credit for the fact that they have a romantic interlude at the beginning, and then they have the conversation in bed that says, we're not going to have a relationship. We're just going to have this working relationship. And then he does learn that she's messy, and he lives with her messy and all of these things over time. And I don't truly believe it either, but I think the intent is a much better representation of the way that love stories should be told in Hollywood, of it takes effort, it takes time, it takes choosing a partner. And that's what Mike
versus
does,
like, love is just finding the glass slipper.
Right. Exactly.
Yes.
And I believe that what they're trying to tell us is that Mike chose the mess, right? Mike chose the difficulty with her in it. I don't think they do a good job of telling that, but I'm so glad that they tried, is kind of how I feel about it.
Yes. Agreed. One. Yes.
And I believe that they can work together again on another production.
the characters.
I don't believe that they're in love, but I believe that, you know, maybe they're choosing it. I mean, Mike has a different love interest in each Magic Mike movie. So, you know,
so
take your pick.
I still miss Brooke. I think that was a horrible thing. That fell apart. Yeah. Brooke was the best. Look, did they need to go to London in this thing? Salma Hayek's from Mexico. He's, you know, Florida. Nope.
Another needless thing. Yes.
And it's so tropey. Like, I just found myself, like, this was a real head slapper that Soderbergh would choose to do the travel to London montage and show all the stupidest, like, tourist stuff.
That's so Soderbergh, though.
You're right. I should not have expected anything less.
It's the Ocean's 11 piece of, like, we're going someplace and boom, 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 cuts to all the touristy stuff. I mean, yes,
he gets
off a double-decker bus. Everyone's
sipping tea with a tall hat made of feathers.
Yeah.
Or
it's opera glasses.
Yes.
I don't I didn't think it needed to go to London. I thought that was sort of a cheap thing. And again, it goes back to what you guys said earlier, that this was a movie that was delivering different things from the DNA of the Magic Mike franchise. They forgot what Magic Mike was. And I think in addition to getting rid of the core guys as the Magic Mike bus, getting rid of weird, I cannot believe I'm saying this out loud. Getting rid of Florida is also a interesting choice. Mm-hmm. To the peril of Magic Mike. Like, he's a Tampa guy. Miami, Tampa. Like, that's part of the gestalt of Magic Mike. And I let's just say that maybe, like, I have one credit for they should always leave this movie in the state of Florida. And I'm never going to say it again about any other movie.
Yep. Or the Deep South, at least. Because Myrtle Beach is South Carolina. But you know.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. Myrtle Beach carries the same vibe. That's right.
I will say that's where it became more step up, because it moved away from being strippers to really dancers. And that was the leap, because that's the dancing that happens here. I mean, that whole recruiting, you know, building the team montage of finding the best dancers in each of these different styles of dance told me this was going to be a different type of movie. You know, again, maybe it's because I'd been prefaced with that whole connection to the stage show they built, that this was going to be really about dance, not about dudes taking their clothes off. They do get to the stripping part, but to me, it was the focus was on the dance. And to me, that justified.
Right. They kept their pants on.
Yeah, mostly. This time. Yes. That justified the move to London. You know, that gave me, I'm like, okay, because they can pull in from everywhere in Europe.
So I agree with you, Steve. And then why do they say they make the big stripper chant before they go on stage? Because they're not actually stripping. It's really just a dance review. So like that again, they're really wanting to try to tap into that Magic Mike DNA, but it's a different movie.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of thing. The parts that were Magic Mike were very enjoyable, and they just needed a lot more of them.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Although here's just as a final point, I wouldn't have expected to say about it, that I don't know that there was enough stripping in this movie to that point. Like, part of what makes the movie titillating is confronting subjects, the people they're stripping for, with the sort of full-throated attempt at challenging cultural norms. Like, that's why stripping is titillating in the first place, is to see naked people out of context in front of you, and you are not naked. That's what stripping is all about. Like, that's the cultural thing, right? And the first two movies, I think, did a pretty good job of that. The first one in particular, because it lives inside the club. The second one less so, because it was performative for other performers and for like the whole "we gotta go to regionals" thing is.
But
is,
then it really increased the diversity.
Yes,
is it, what right. the really second one was doing the with in the age, mm-hmm. different nationalities. Yeah,
yeah. Race, I think this is another one that doesn't lean in maybe heavily enough on what makes Magic Mike titillating, is that there was less stripping. It was more dancing. And I love the dancing. The dancing was great. And also more stripping in the dancing for a Magic Mike movie. I'm curious, Steve, you are among us. You're the
the first stripper out
you're
of all.
You're the dance dad. Although I was about to say stripper dad, and I would regret that. So it's out there. You're the dance dad. Like, how does this hold up to your like experience of dance culture?
Wait, why are we saying the words dance dad?
Because
I don't know.
I got daughters who dance. Yes, I have a dancer in the family. So my youngest was actually I don't know how many years ago, was at a dance convention and took a class led by Steven Twitch Boss. And my wife was there and actually got to talk with his mom and grandmother who were there. This was just shortly after So You Think You Can Dance and everything. And, you know, so yeah.
That's where I know him.
That loss earlier this year. It was something, because I didn't pay attention to cast. I thought, oh, is he going to be in this? Because that's going to be really rough.
It would be for me too.
Yeah. But that, Pete, to your question, I saw a lot of like the step up stuff in this and the types of dances, like the suits dance, even the water dance. That was something I think in Step Up to the Streets or Step Up 3, where there was a lot of water used. And so, yes, it's different when you're out in the streets with the water, where, how do you drain all of that? But just the choreography, the powerful, I have to say, that last dance, as they're cutting to Salma Hayek and the story that he's telling in that dance, was so powerful. I had not seen anything that moved me that much in other dance movies. So I think it's done really, really well. For me, there is enough stripping because you got the three ladies in the chairs. They got to have guys grinding on them. We've got a couple other dance numbers where it's guys taking their shirts off and all of that. But to me, when I finished this movie, I called home and said, hey, this has less. This is more of a step up movie than a Magic Mike movie. There's less stripping, more dancing. To me, much more comfortable to sit and watch with my family. This one, I have to say, going into the theater by myself, sitting by myself, surrounded by women, was real interesting. And the fact that I hadn't eaten dinner.
I got a few teehees.
Yeah. Oh, no. But the fact that I hadn't eaten, so I got a hot dog. And so I'm sitting there surrounded by women eating a hot dog, watching men take their shirts off, made me feel just a bit uncomfortable. But I do have to say, I saw this in Atmos. And the sound design, when we get to that section where it is just the show, I felt I was there because the sound, the cheering, the clap, everything. I thought it's not a completely packed theater. And there are lots of women here who are cheering, but it really filled and made me feel like for that dance, I was there in the show watching that because it was just, I was like, how are we going to end this? Oh, we're going to get a straight, whatever, 25 minutes of the dance show. And so just consistent dance number after dance number for me, just, that was what made me really, really enjoy this movie, is that strong amount of dance and done really, really well with various dancers with their different styles of dance and how that was all worked together. And there was, really enjoyable for me. I would watch that section of the movie. I would watch that last part over and over again.
Easily.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure.
That and the bus. I want to see the bus.
And the bus.
Sequence.
And the bus.
Right now.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I want to see the bus sequence. That was the absolute highlight. That and the beginning dance.
Mm-hmm.
Between Duda
and the house.
And that beginning piece, because this was something I wondered, like, how do we connect this? Because I'd seen in the previews, everybody's seen in the trailer, like, oh, don't I know you? Weren't you a cop? And I was like, oh, that's a nice little callback to the first. But the way that was connected in the story, of like, because I'm like, what reason does she have? Oh, Kim, who was a college student when Mike was a cop in that first movie, is now her attorney. And that gives that, I was like, this is really smart writing to connect these pieces, to give Mike a reason to do this. Because I thought, what's his reason for getting back into dance? What is this? And the way that was written to pull him in, I thought was really smart. And I really enjoyed that way to kick this thing off. Because I thought, he's lost his business, he's bartending. How is he ending up in London, running a dance show? And I thought that was such a nice callback to the first one. And
agreed.
Yeah.
I think you really nail it. I think so much of this movie sits on the back, firmly on the back of Channing Tatum's extraordinary charisma. I have nothing.
I thought you were going to talk about his extraordinary back. But,
He also has an extraordinary back.
Yes,
he's extraordinary. He's a specimen. He is an absolute specimen. This Channing Tatum, I think that this movie for me, just in, as we kind of get toward wrapping up, this movie for me swings much more widely than the last two, in the stuff that just doesn't work at all to the stuff that really does and is really filmed and produced beautifully, that just looks good, with exception of the major dance numbers that we've already said are fantastic. Do you have any specific thoughts about the presentation of the thing, camera, the way, Soderbergh works the frame, JJ?
Well, that handheld scene that leads up to what becomes the dance, right? Where he's saying goodbye to her and she's exiting the theater. And then they stay with him handheld. They walk around, they follow Selma Hayek, and then they come back to him looking up at him with the theater in the background. It's very confusing. It's not a very tightly controlled handheld shot, and it's very loose. It doesn't really seem to make sense I guess, other than to literally draw your attention to the fact that this is happening in real life now, because later on it's going to be the centerpiece of our show. But at the moment, it really took me out of things because I was like, what are you trying to show here? It was very confusing for the emotion that was going on, because again, that sort of thing of, oh, he has fallen in love with her, but we never saw that on screen. So that whole like going away thing was very, very confusing to me. All of the camera was really meant to be showing us something. I just got confused at what those things were from time to time based on their choices.
Tom?
For me, two things. There was way too many stop the musics. that's just got to be lazy screenwriting at some point, of like going into a number and then someone storming in from off screen saying stuff like this. I mean, it happened like four different times. That's obscene. But who cares? And then the other one, you guys had the cat intermission, right?
Yes. What was that?
Yes.
What was that? What was that?
What was it?
I mean, Soderbergh's such a weirdo, and that goes back to like his Schizopolis stuff of like, he's just has a playground sometimes, but what was that? Something like that can really be a home run for me, because it's like, go for it. This felt rude. And that's a weird way to say it. But I was like, did you just not have any kind of transition to get to her up there? Did you forget to film something? Like, that was just insane. Was there any kind of a connection in the script that I missed?
A guy was holding
a puppy. What was that?
Yeah, no, I literally thought it was... I wasn't sure if it was me. I mean, watching it, you know, it's very confusing.
I just took that as
That's not allowed.
I'd have to watch it again if that was, because we're going to the theater and seeing a show, and shows have intermissions. Was that to signify that, oh, we've gotten this far into the show, there's an intermission that the audience is actually experiencing? But I'm not going to show you that, because you know what an intermission is. And I, you know, why would I film people like, oh, getting up from their seats and talking and then coming back and resuming the show? It's just like,
it just moves time forward. That's how I took quickly.
I don't know that it worked, but as
that's
well.
An insane
but,
way to.
But it, what? I mean, everybody busted up laughing at that. And I thought it did its purpose if it's there to make us think about it, remember it, because it definitely stands out.
I don't know what this is a thing, but as we're talking about it, I literally looked up cat intermission Magic Mike. And the first YouTube result that comes up is Magic Mike XXL, parenthetical, the cute kitten edition.
What?
It's not. I'm telling you.
What?
What does that mean? What is there, it? Can you say it? Can you see what it is without?
Yeah, it's a joke video on YouTube.
Is it cats playing Magic Mike?
Acting like they're being Magic Mike XXL. So I'm just, there's a wild hypothesis, just going to throw it out there. Maybe he's referring to something that was created about
views?
An earlier film. Oh, that's, I didn't click on it. I get nervous.
If it's a whirlwind success, viral success.
It's of course playing, and we didn't want to play, but it's, views, 100,000 views. That's not a lot.
That's not.
So I don't think so. Okay.
No.
I don't know. But that's the first thing that comes up when you look up cat intermission Magic Mike is Magic Mike XXL cute kitten edition.
I was hoping that all three of us had the cat and Steve didn't. That Steve has all this weird stuff before the movie and we have this bizarre thing in the middle of the movie. It's like, what's happening, AMC or wherever we saw it?
Right.
I love it.
Oh dear.
Now it's just Soderbergh being Soderbergh and giving us all the things. I mean, that's,
I guess.
And yep. I've said many times on this podcast that I love novelty, right? Yeah. And Andy's asked me from time to time, he said, well, what do you mean by novelty? And that's the kind of stuff that I find to be novel in film, where you don't really necessarily know what it's in. It's a card that's just dropped in. It may have a reason, it may not. It gives you the ability to figure it out for yourself. This one felt really far out of place. I'm going to say that. But I like that kind of stuff when it's a handoff to something. You don't just put it in there for no reason. There is a reason why it exists. We just don't know what that reason is.
You know what it reminds me of? Very different movies, obviously, but in Death Proof, part of the Grindhouse movies, the one that Tarantino directed, there's a whole frame missing part when she starts to do the lap dance for Kurt Russell. And there's a whole frames missing thing. It goes, and then the movie starts again. They filmed all of it. And it's in the special features when you buy the DVD or have the special features. Maybe there was just something that he really liked, but they had to take it out because the movie is already almost too long. Two hours for four great sequences is too long for me. Maybe he's doing one of those of like, hey, everybody, something's happening here and you will all find out later. I don't know.
Sure.
It's interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Well, it's Soderberghian for sure.
Yes. Because he's a weirdo.
He's he's a weirdo. He's but my I'm generally kind of weirdo. In the bag for Soderbergh. And I think my hunch is this movie might just age better than the first watch did, if only anchored by those big pieces.
Sure.
Because now I know what I'm looking forward to. On a second watch, I'm going to watch it for those big dance numbers and less so much for the vapid emptiness of the actual characters that have been written devoid of all personality and motivation.
Well, unlike that one dancer Soderbergh had other movies. That one dancer had a real big beard. So what more do you need to know?
You're so right.
Yeah, his dancing, his stage name was actually Bobby Big Beard. So
Bobby Big Beard.
JJ's confused. That was my Bobby dancing.
Bobby is actually what's in quotes.
I think,
unless you have any other points, I think we need to move on to talking about how we are going to rank it.
Yeah.
All right. Letterboxd. You know what Letterboxd is. Letterboxd is our favorite social media network for movie lovers. And you can be a part of Letterboxd too. If you fall in love with it, just like we have, then you can head over there and support Letterboxd and this show by using the code NEXTREEL at checkout. And you can upgrade to a pro or patron membership yourself by and save 20% along the way. Fantastic Kiwi team. You know, Andy has been to Auckland and met with the guys who run this thing.
I didn't like, know that.
We've had boots on the ground in New Zealand at Letterboxd headquarters. That's how much we love Letterboxd. They're fantastic, great supporters, and we're happy to be partnered with them. So head over there. And if you really want a quick and easy way to just head over to thenextreel.com/letterboxd and you can, it'll take you right over there to the checkout page where the code is already applied. So bully for you. All right. How are we going to do this? JJ, where do you start?
I am nervous that I'm going to skew this in the positive direction because I just love the franchise so much. I mean, that's what I kind of tried to talk about in my intro. Mm-hmm. I didn't laugh cry nearly as much as I did in XXL in enjoyment, but I still did. In this movie. So it is on the positive side for me. I give it a 3 stars and a heart because I'd want to watch any of these three movies anytime just to see the fun dancing and those sequences. So I think your point about it possibly aging up better for us, I think is true. And in connection with those others, I'm all about it. So I give it a 3 stars.
Do you have right off the dome what you would give Magic Mike and XXL?
I would give them both at least 4, maybe a 4.5 for those two. Especially for the first one, because the first one surprised me so much about and it in the realm of Soderbergh movies, like it's a fantastic Soderbergh movie. This one feels like it's a little bit less so, but it's still enjoyable. So I think I'd probably say 4.5 for the first one, 4 for XXL, and 3 for this one.
Okay, Steve.
Yes. I give it a heart.
How do you rate it, Steve? Are you here?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, today we're talking about Magic Mike's Last Dance. Steve just rebooted.
I give it... So I give this one a heart, and I recently watched Magic Mike and Magic Mike XXL, and was contemplating where this one fell. Because, Pete, you're absolutely right. XXL is like Pitch Perfect 2 or whatever. That one came in at 3 stars. The first one I remember liking a lot. On a second watch, it just didn't seem as solid for me. And like I said, I think it's the dual protagonist issue and it's just clunky. So that one was at 3 stars for me. And I was ready to give this one 3 stars. But as I was sitting halfway through this, I'm like, yeah, this is okay. Probably 3 stars. But I'm moving it up to 3.5 just on that whole the show. Just everything, the power of all of that. So I'm going with 3.5 and a heart.
All right.
Okay. All right, Tom.
Yeah, I'll give it a heart. It's too much of a sketch of a movie.
Just a heart?
Just a heart. No numbers. No. I'll give it a heart, and I can't give it personally any higher than a 3 because it's just too much of a sketch of a movie, and there's too many weird things that didn't work for me. But I will rewatch this whole movie at some point, but I'm happy to give it at the very least a 3 because I really look forward to fast-forwarding through this movie to certain points which blew me away. And when I catch myself alone in a theater, well, not alone, but I didn't go with anyone else, slightly bouncing up and down and smiling, which is a performative thing. But when you find yourself, oh, I'm doing that just because I'm feeling something so deep, I could never give it anything less than a 3. So I'm going to give a 3 and say that it might go up to like a 3.5 at some point. But right now, 3 and a heart sounds good.
And you were, where were you on the first two?
4, 3.5, 3.
So we're descending. Okay.
4.5, 3.5, 3.
Okay. All right. All right. For the record,
4.7.
Noted. I love that you talked about seeing the movie alone and like bouncing. I realized when I walked out of the movie that that was sort of my experience too, that I feel like I watched all those dance scenes with like my butt clenched, right? Like I was like, oh, like tight. I was all tight as if I was there. And then I checked my abs and stop thinking about that.
Wait, in that situation, were you in the audience or one of the dancers? Yeah,
I was I was in the audience watching it. And then I was, in the movie. I thought you meant, did I get up and like Rocky Horror this thing?
No, I mean, when you were you tight-butted because you were identifying
imagining
with the
myself
dancers?
As a dancer. Yeah, got I it. Was dancing. Yeah.
Nice.
Can't you see it? Uh-huh. Yeah. So, anyhow, I think that the first two movies are 4-star for me for very different reasons, weirdly, and hearts. And this one, I think I'm going to go for a 3. I was actually tempted before we started this conversation to go for a 2-star and a heart for this one and put it more in the realm of guilty pleasure. But honestly, Steve's enthusiasm for the depth of the movie that and their chemistry that I didn't see has actually provoked me to lift it a star. I think that's I'm going to see that again. And Edna Eaglebauer was worth it. I did love the hot seat bit. That was great. That using was the older women, the more clearly British restrained women in that scene, I thought was really great. So
I liked it too.
4-4-3, 3 stars and a heart for this one, and I'm glad for it. Now, what comes next? I'm so glad you asked. We deliberated. We deliberated heartily.
Don't get us started.
Oh, it was big. But we are going to come back next month. The Film Board will gather to talk about Scream 6. Woo! We're going to Manhattan. Scream Goes Manhattan. We are very excited to take a look at that film. We have talked about all the other Scream films on the next reel, and so I'm sure Andy will not care for the fact that we're breaking up the set. We'll probably do a show on it anyway. Nice. Who knows? So I'm excited to talk about that. That comes out, what did we say? The 10th? Yep. 11th? 12th? 10th?
Yep.
Yeah, so it'll be the week 12th. Of the 12th. We're going to... the show will be out. So be on the lookout for recording there in Discord. Don't forget, you can hang out in our online community, thenextreel.com/Discord. It'll whisk you over to the invitation page where you can accept that and join the public community. But really, if you want to do more, if you want to support the show and help us out, you can join, become a member at truestory.fm/TNR-membership. I think we have that routed. thenextreel.com/membership will get you there too. Anyway, you sign up on the website and you become a supporter of the show, and it helps us continue to do what we do and grow the show and invest time and attention and energy to doing more shows about movies. We sure appreciate you being a part of this community. And it also gives you access to all the super secret channels in Discord, which is really fun.
Secret.
And don't forget, you can join the live stream as a member. You can actually watch us record this show live and chat along with us as we record. We love when that happens. So thank you, everybody. And really, thank you, thugs. JJ, great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Tommy, always a treat.
womp, womp, womp.
And Steve.
Oh, my abs are sore. Or my lack of abs is sore after watching this movie.
And my butt. I'll be right with we'll you next month. Right here on the Film Board. Here on the Film Board, we have covered quite a variety of great page-to-screen adaptations over the years, from superheroes like Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises, based on stories like Nightfall and The Dark Knight Returns,
to horror and sci-fi like Max Brooks's World War Z and Hiroshi Sakazuraka's All You Need Is Kill, which became one of our favorites, Edge of Tomorrow, with Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt.
And who could forget Andy Weir's stranded astronaut adventure, The Martian, or Dave Eggers' tech thriller, The Circle?
Supposedly so much better than the movie.
We've also explored Stephen King epics like The Dark Tower and It, biopics like Damien Chazelle's First Man,
and sweeping sagas like Denis Villeneuve's take on Frank Herbert's Dune.
And don't forget Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, based on David Grand's nonfiction book about the 1920s murders of the Osage Nation. I just finished the book, and it's fantastic.
It's always fascinating to look at the source material, and we often do as the book lovers we are. For those of you out there who love to do the same, head to thenextreel.com/originals to find all of our past episodes and dive deeper into these adapted stories.
And it's not just stories. We've included things like the video games Uncharted and Detective Pikachu.
That's right. Thenextreel.com/originals is your one-stop shop for in-depth looks at the sources for cinematic adaptations that we have discussed. Every purchase you make supports the Film Board and the Next Reel's family of shows.
So what are you waiting for? Head to thenextreel.com/originals and get your next read today.